The last part of this course, I want to remark the following about the exam. I think the easiest, so there's a technical problem. The problem is that Crystal and myself, we start tomorrow night from Saturday to Sunday for our this week for this year for our vacation for 2 weeks. That means that we are for 2 weeks reachable by email, but not always reachable. So if you write me an email regarding the course during the next 2 weeks, I will answer to you, but it might be a delay of 1 or 2 days if I don't have an email in the Alps. So this is we are in the mountains. And so the easiest solution would be that if Pierre that we post the problems on Monday afternoon to our web page. And if Pierre is if could do this until Monday, and then we give you 2 weeks' time. And after this, within these 2 weeks, you have to return the problems to Pierre, the solution, and then he takes his time to look at the solutions, and then Pierre informs us whether you did pass or not. So this would be the easiest solution. Otherwise, I would need to write an email to you, but I'm not sure because there are some participants which might not be on my email list that I missed some of the participants. So I would not see a problem that the problems are public. I'm not sure about Pierre. What do you think?
No, it's no problem. So I will post. I will give you the problems this afternoon. Okay.
Okay.
If we can discuss a little bit about that, and
Yes.
after the course, for instance,
Yes.
and then yeah, the student will have 2 weeks from next Monday
Yes.
to give an answer. Yeah, and
Okay.
of course, I would prefer individual solution, but nothing can prevent you to exchange. So.
Okay.
Yeah, it would be nicer if I had didn't have I don't know how many times the same answer.
Yes. Okay. So we so then we post the problems whenever we haven't them. But the 2 weeks would run from next Monday on. So I would post then the it would be then in 2 weeks next Monday. I give you some more, maybe until midnight Monday. You send this to Pierre, and then whatever he gets until that time, he takes it. But I will post the date and the. For returning to PR on the web page. I think that's the easiest thing. Otherwise, if you have any problems regarding technical things, please contact me. I will for sure I will answer. And regarding mathematics, I think the first address is PR, and if I can help, then of course I will try to do this as well. Yeah. Okay, I hand over now to Pierre. If he would like to say something technical, please continue. Otherwise, take your
No, it's
second part.
okay. Just feel free. Okay, we can stay online after just after the course. So feel free to ask me question if you have, in particular on the problem. So you write me an email, and I'll answer. There is just so I'm going to write two things. My email address. I don't know if you have it, and also another thing. Which is the references for this the part of the course I'm giving now. So to everyone, so my email address is the following. I'm writing down it on the chat. This is my email address, and the reference to the course is a CIMI course we gave 2 years ago. At Chetraru, and if you are interested in what I'm saying just now, and also in Minfield Game, you can find references in this course, and in particular in the contribution that I did with Alessio Poretta, and a contribution by Filippo Santambrogio, who wrote a lot about Minfield Game of potential type, which are basically Minfield control, in fact. Okay. Okay, so let me complete the course. So I will briefly complete the proof of the existence of a solution, then discuss the optimality condition, and then explain why this optimality condition can be interpreted in terms of mean field game. So I will explain what a mean field game is. And feel free to, if you have questions. I'm completely ready to answer. Okay. So I had a problem with this term just a while ago, and I'm going to give an interpretation of it now. Okay. So I was stuck because I could not remember the genre transform of that stuff, which is a little bit silly of me. But so I'm now explaining this term precisely, and to show you why it's convex and why it's coercive. So what I want to discuss is this, okay? How to explain this term? And for doing that, let me say a few words about what's going on in R2. So what I claim is the following fact, which is obvious, which comes from the Legendre transform of the Legendre transform of A of the quadratic function. So let me take three numbers, okay? So three quantities. So A is in RD, and B is in R. Okay. Let me take the soup over C in RD of A scalar product with C minus C square over 2 times B. Okay. Then I leave you as an exercise, but it's a trivial exercise, that this quantity is equal to A square over 2B if B is positive, 0 if A equals 0, and B equals 0, and plus infinity otherwise. Okay, so this quantity, okay, can pointwise can be interpreted as the soup of this function. So note that this quantity, therefore, this is convex in the pair AB, okay, because it's a soup of linear functions of AB. So this is a convex function of AB, okay. So now, if you want to do that in the term, now remember that E and M are measures, so that's it might bother you to manipulate that. But in fact, you do exactly the same, okay, except that. So instead of doing it pointwise, you do it globally by remembering that the space of measure can be interpreted as the dual space of continuous maps. Okay, so what I call the integral of E square M is just the soup. Okay, now I cannot take a C which is in RD, but I take a C which is a continuous map from 0 t. Times RD into RD, so it's a vector field. Okay, and I'm replacing this quantity by exactly the same stuff in terms of. So this is an integral between 0 and t, integral over RD of this term. So here, A is the role of A is played by E. Okay, so it's phi of tx integrated against the vector measure D, the vector measure E, okay, so E of T, DT, DX. Okay. And this term, okay, it's exactly the same. It's integral over the length of phi square integrated again B, which is now the measure M. So by definition, this guy is this, okay, and it's obvious that it is a convex function of the pair MI. Okay. And now, if you have, so what I explained first is that because the estimate you have on alpha n and mn, so alpha n being the harmonic derivative nicodim of en, respect to mn. So if you have this kind of estimate, then you have uniform estimate on the mn, okay, which implies a paracompactness of mn in this space. And here, but that's not enough to pass to the limit in this kind of expression. So what you just need is to check that the measure E is bounded, okay, and this is also the case because of that by Cauchy-Schwarz. Okay, So let me write it very formally, but what I claim is that in order to pass to the limit, the only thing you need to know is that E, the sequence En is bounded in terms of measure, and this is the case. So the total variation of En that I write like that is bounded by some constant C because. So I'm going to do it formally, but you can justify it by just smoothing because the integral, the double integral of En can be bounded by Cauchy-Schwarz by En squared divided by Mn. And remembering that Mn is a probability measure. Okay, so this quantity is bounded by assumption, okay, by construction of the minimizing sequence, and this quantity is just finite. It's my bounded by capital T, so it's T to the power of a half because Mn is for any time is a probability measure. Okay, so this shows that in terms of measure, En is bounded, so it has a you can extract a subsequent which converges and blah blah blah. Okay, and it's bounded and absolutely continuous respect to the measure Mn, which itself converges. So this shows that you can extract a subsequent which converges, okay, weakly. And because this term is lower semi-continuous, because convex and coercive, okay, this gives you the passage to the limit into the term which is here. And this proves the convergence. Questions? It's a little bit technical. It's also more difficult because it's on a sheet instead of blackboard, but it's not, I mean, the basic proof is there. So now I want to write the optimality condition. So we know that there is a minimizer and we want to characterize this minimizer, at least. One of the reasons is to get some regularity of this minimizer and to understand why and to understand how to compute it numerically and to manipulate it. Okay, so this is the reason we write this theorem, which really characterizes it characterizes the minimizer when f is convex, and when f is not convex, it gives a necessary condition. So it says that if so M alpha is a minimum of infinity, so it just proves that there exists such a minimum, okay, then okay. I need more assumptions. So the assumption I need, I'm going to state them very loosely by saying that F is smooth. Okay. So let me introduce a notation that would be more convenient in the next line. So let me call G of M. So here you have seen in the cost. So we can come back to the cost. There is this strange term which pops up. Okay, so this integral of f at time t, integrated, computed at m, and integrated against m. Okay, so this quantity here, from now on, I'm going to call it g. Okay, it will be simpler in the expression I'm going to write. So it's the integral of f against computed at m against m. Okay. So the technical assumption I'm doing is that this quantity that we know is continuous, huh? It's continuous because f is continuous, okay, and you integrate a bounded function against m, so by composition it's continuous. So I'm assuming that it's smooth enough in the sense that it has at least one, it is L2 differentiable. So it has a L2 derivative. In the sense I discussed before. And I'm assuming that delta G over delta M, if you remember, it depends on two variables. And I'm assuming that that guy is smooth. And by smooth, I mean C2 plus alpha or something like that, no more than C2. Okay, then this will ensure that M and alpha are relatively nice. Then there exists a smooth function. So, okay, let me comment a little bit about that. So, the optimization problem I have is an optimization under constraint, and the constraint is the constraint on the equation satisfied by M and alpha. It's a Kolmogorov equation. So, it's a minimization of a functional over a constraint, which is a functional constraint, the Kolmogorov equation. Okay. And you know that when you're doing optimization under constraint, there is a multiplier which pops up. And this multiplier is precisely the function u that I'm going to describe now, which is in C2 and which is real valued. Such that on the one hand, you can relate u and alpha. So more precisely, alpha is nothing but minus du, the gradient of u with respect to the space variable. And this holds m almost everywhere. Okay, so in fact, with the assumption I did, m has a full support. So it holds everywhere. And u satisfies a Hamilton-Jacobi equation, which is the following. So if you take the time derivative of u minus Laplace and u plus a half of du square, this is equal to the flat derivative, to the L2 derivative of g. That you compute at M of T So this is an equation which holds from 0 T to V. And this is a backward equation, as you can see from the sign of the heat equation. Okay, so this is an equation which is a terminal condition. And this terminal condition here, because I didn't put the terminal cost in the problem, is just zero. So if I had a terminal cost for my initial optimization problem, I would have this terminal cost here, or the derivative of this terminal cost. Okay. So I've got a multiplier which satisfies the PDE. Okay. Now I need a little bit to rush, so let me say how. So what is the ingredient in for doing the proof? I don't have time to do the proof. So the ingredient of the proof are the min-max theorem, and you can prove that by min-max theorem by writing the criterion satisfied by M and alpha, okay, and doing the penalization, and putting introducing into the cost the penalization, penalizing the equation satisfied by M and alpha, okay, the Kolmogorov equation. And then you write the min-max theorem, and if you work well, okay, you end up with a dual optimization problem, which more or less makes this quantity appear. Okay, so it's I'm obliged to be a little bit fuzzy in order to proceed and talk a little bit about mean field gain, but this is really the idea of the problem. So you can see that in the Cheney course. So for the proof. This is a Cheney course. Okay, you can find it on the internet, and if you don't have it, please write me and I can send you the course. Okay, so to complete the program, I want now a little bit to talk about mean field gain and how the problem we just solved is related to mean field gain. So compared to mean field control, mean field gain has the particularity that you no longer assume that the player, that global planner minimize some quantity, okay, that we discussed before, but you assume that each player controls its dynamics and minimize the quantity. Okay, so in the n player game, So mean field games has to do with differential games with infinitely many players. Okay, and I'm going to explain how it pops up by studying the n player game. So a game with finite number of players. So each player has a cost. So for each between 1 and n. Each player has a cost, which depends on all the controls alpha j. And this cost, to fix the IDs, I'm going to write it exactly as I did for the optimal control problem, the mean field control problem. So it's something where player I has to play for its control. Okay. And there is an interaction cost which couples all the players. And this interaction cost, I call it G. And in fact, it would be, I call it G, but it should not be G. So let me call it, uh, Sorry, I'm going to use another letter because it's not obvious how it's related to G. So let me call it Kallisch-Caffrick G. Okay, so it's a function of time of the position of player I and on the empirical measure of the other player. So I'm assuming that there is a symmetry between the players. Okay. And each player tries to minimize this kind of stuff. And there is, as usual, the dynamics. And again, for simplicity, I'm assuming that the controls are decoupled. I could have a more complicated expression here and the volatility term, but let's forget about that. Okay, with an initial condition. And you might be aware that what is a Nash equilibrium in this setting? So the difference between this problem and the problem we saw before is that each guy, I, is going to minimize he wants to minimize his quantity, okay? So it's not the same, of course, as minimizing the sum of all these guys, okay, over all the alpha. It wouldn't give the same stuff in general. It seldom gives the same stuff. So we are dealing with what is called decentralized minimization problem. And the good notion for that is the notion of Nash equilibrium. Which says that the alpha bar I for I between 1 and n is a Nash equilibrium. If for any I and for any deviation alpha I of player I, his cost computed at alpha bar I and alpha bar j. So here I'm using the usual notation of game, which is that here this is a collection for all the controls for the other player different from alpha from I. Okay, and here I'm singling out the control of alpha I. And this quantity, which is the optimal cost, is less than what he would get if he or she, this player I, was deviating from alpha. Okay, so this is the notion of Nash equilibrium. So this is the notion of Nash equilibrium for n player game, okay? And now let's try to guess what's going on when you pass to the limit. Well, this is the same story as before. When you pass to the limit, what you expect is in fact that you have propagation of chaos also in this case. And that's not easy to prove at all, that you have propagation of chaos. And therefore this measure becomes deterministic and becomes the law of all the guys. Okay, so the mean field game equilibrium, which is obtained by passing formally to the limit, okay, so what is it? So you do exactly the same as what we did for the mean field control problem, that is, you consider that this guy is almost deterministic, okay, and is given by the law of each single particle, because when you have infinitely many, if you have a large number of particles, okay, the empirical measure is almost deterministic. So what is a mean field game equilibrium? It's a control maybe a little bit fuzzy, or what I call a control alpha, such that alpha bar, such that okay, so it's sorry. Let me formal. Let me say. Let me introduce. Is a pair. So let me put at the same time the control and the measure. So M is the flow of measure. So alpha bar is the control. And M is a flow of measure, so a continuous function in 0t is values in, let's say, P2 over D. So it's a flow of probability measure, such that you have two conditions. So I want to say something like that, okay? But but here, I've got infinitely many guys playing, okay? So because there are infinitely many, the measure, the distribution of particles is fixed, okay? And what you get is that the expectation, so alpha bar minimizes the infimum over alpha of the limit problem, which is very close to the mean field gain problem, except that the measure M is fixed. So M of T here is fixed. I'm not minimizing over this measure. Sorry, I'm saying something stupid. So here it should be XT. And here it's alpha T, that's correct. Where you have the usual link between alpha and X. And B is some generic quantum motion. And Z and the initial condition is the same law as ZI before. Okay. So that's the first condition. And you need an equilibrium condition saying that if all the players are going to play alpha bar, and in fact, so let me call X bar. So here I've got X for a generic control alpha. And X bar is associated to alpha bar. Okay, so if I put alpha bar here, I've got X bar. Okay. And the second condition says that, in fact, the measure M is realized as the law of X bar. Okay, so the distribution of all the players is the optimal one. So it's a strange concept, which is somehow the generalization of Nash equilibrium when you have infinitely many players which have a very small role. Okay, if you have plenty of players and each of them have a very small role in the crowd, when this player deviates, if you remember the notion of Nash equilibrium, when this player deviates, of course it changes its cost, but not too much. It changes its cost, not too much, because in fact the other player do not deviate, doesn't see him because it's small, okay? And so they don't change the strategy, and therefore the distribution of player does not deviate. So the distribution of player at equilibrium is M of T, okay? And when one of the player deviates, it changes its cost because it is a cost. In the cost, there is the dynamics and the control. Okay, so this changes the cost, but it does not change the global behavior of all the players. And I finish by a theorem which says that, which makes the link with the previous part. So assume that the function g is nothing but the function which appears in the necessary condition delta g over delta m. So remember, in the necessary condition, okay, we had this right hand side which was given by delta g over delta m. Okay, and that. And let um alpha be for such that m alpha is a minimizer of infinity, and u is given by the theorem of necessary condition. Okay, so you solve the Hamilton-Jacobi equation associated with right-hand side, which is given by that. So it's given by the optimality conditions. Then the control alpha and the measure M is a mean field game equilibrium. Okay, so you have this kind of result. So this one is just a verification theorem. So the proof is a verification theorem. Which means that you just need to plug u into the dynamics associated with any control, and to compare it with the u evaluated along the path for the optimal control, to show that you have indeed this relation. Okay, but it's not too difficult. So what we have seen through this course is. First, the basic material to handle mean field games. So, in other words, the analysis on space of measure, the differentiability respect to the measure, and the link with the mean field theory. Okay, so this was rigorous as I could do it in the course of in this lecture. And then, what I tried to do is to explain how you can find mean field control. How you can deal mean field control and how this mean field control can be related with mean field games in a particular case. So this particular case is called potential game, in the sense that the mean field equilibria can be found by a minimization procedure, which is not the case in general. Okay, so it's a particular case. So and in the end, what you find is how to build and to compute ultimately a mean field game equilibrium. By solving a minimization problem. Okay, I think it's good time to stop, and I'm ready to answer questions if you like, and we can stay online and chat if you want, or in any case. So for those who want to solve the problem, I'm going to give it to Andy to Stefan in this afternoon, and please feel free to ask questions about.
So thank you very much for this very nice talk, for the very nice lecture series. I must say myself, I learned really a lot of this week, and I was very happy that Pierre did do this course, although it was online. I have just one question. Are there some...